You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
So from 2012 to 2018, I was the first United Nations independent expert or special rapporteur on human rights and the environment. What that means, well, the United Nations Human Rights Council, the main United Nations human rights body, is composed of governments, and they meet three times a year to adopt resolutions and make statements on human rights. But they also appoint individual experts to study and report on particular human rights problems. So there are country rapporteurs that focus on particular countries, and there are also thematic rapporteurs. So there's a special rapporteur on torture, for example, and one on extreme poverty, and one on indigenous rights. So in 2012, they decided for the first time to have one of these positions, one of these mandates, focus on human rights and the environment. And I had the honor of receiving that appointment. So what that meant was, I was asked to clarify the relationship between human rights and the environment, what human rights obligations have to say about environmental problems. But also, especially as the years went on, I received complaints from people around the world alleging violations of their human rights in relation to environmental harm. I visited countries in many different regions of the world and issued reports on how those countries were doing in bringing human rights to bear on environmental problems.
So, because it's when you say that, I mean, human rights and the environment, that's so broad. How much is this to do with climate change?
A great deal of it has to do with climate change. You're right, it's a very broad topic. One way of thinking about it is that there are two basic ways that human rights and the environment interact with each other. One is environmental harm can interfere with the full enjoyment of a very large number of human rights. And of course, climate change is a good example of that. Climate change is going to interfere with the enjoyment of rights of people living in small island states, living in far north regions, living in the Sahel, but eventually it's going to interfere with the rights of virtually everyone. The other way that human rights and the environment interact with each other is that exercising your human rights, such as your rights of freedom of speech, freedom of association, your rights of information, your rights of remedy, those things can help make sure that your country's environmental policies are robust and reflect the interests of the people who are most directly affected. So climate change, again, it matters whether people are able to find out about the effects of climate change, whether they're able to pursue legal remedies for the effects on them, and so forth.
These changes are way already happening. They've been happening for so long, yeah. And people have been affected by the climate already for so long. There's places that have very little access to water, for example. I just want to bring it back to this case regarding the man from Kiribati, so Ioane Teitiota. Right. Why is this case, before we get into the actual ruling, but why is this a landmark case in terms of it being the first of its kind?
It's a landmark case because it's the first time that a United Nations human rights body, here the UN Human Rights Committee, but it's the first time that any UN human rights body, any tribunal or quasi-tribunal, has really addressed the problem of climate migrants, people who are being either forced to leave their country because of the effects of climate change or feel that they can't return to their country because of the effects of climate change. And so even though this particular decision was against the applicant and in favor of New Zealand's decision, it's still a very important case because the committee makes clear that in the future, as the effects of climate change worsen, they're basically putting down a marker that future cases making these same kinds of arguments are much more likely to be received positively. That is to be that the committee would be more likely to decide that they do implicate the human rights of the affected people.
So
to put it more bluntly, then countries could not simply return them back to their home countries if they were facing imminent risks of harm to their life or bodily integrity as a result of the effects of the climate crisis.
That's sort of what I found, I guess, misleading in some of the news articles, in the sense that obviously this case lost, this man lost his appeal, and now though people were kind of pointing to this case as a bit of a turning point. So is it more that it's just that kind of recognition that things could be different in the future?
Yes, exactly. I think it has been, I think a lot of the coverage of this has been misleading. They make it sound as if the committee has already reached the decision, that the committee's really just predicting that it might reach in the future, if that makes sense. So instead of saying today, already, people can't be returned to countries like Kiribati, what the committee's really saying is, right now, we affirm that New Zealand made a reasonable decision, but if things... unless things change, unless there's real, robust national and international cooperation to safeguard the lives and communities of people who live in places like Kiribati and other, low-lying South Pacific small island states, for example, then we're going to reach a different decision in the future. But they haven't reached that point yet, and I think that's where the media has been a little bit misleading.
Do you agree with the ruling in that sense, that we're not at that point yet?
Well, as you say, as a factual matter, things already are pretty bad in a lot of places. This involved one particular person and his situation, so it's hard to second-guess their decision just based on the facts that are being presented in this one case. It is remarkable, though, that they essentially accept his arguments, that there are already violent land disputes going on in Kiribati because people are concerned about the shrinking land area, the shrinking arable land area, that water is already being rationed for 60% of the population in South Tarawa, and so forth. So I think to some degree it certainly helped New Zealand that the Human Rights Committee has a deferential approach in cases like this, as long as the government looked at all of the relevant factors, and in other words, made a careful and reasoned decision, then the Human Rights Committee is more likely to defer to them. And New Zealand seems to have done that. In other words, they took seriously his arguments. They just, at the end of the day, disagreed with them.
Mm.
I think what may happen in other countries is that people may start being returned, and I'm sorry, people who make these arguments, people who make the argument that return would jeopardize their life or health as a result of the climate effects, I think what some other countries may do is simply return them without even really hearing those arguments. And I think the committee is also making a pretty strong indication that that would be unacceptable. You have to carefully consider the consequences of returning people to situations in which their lives might be at risk from climate change.
Right.
If you don't even consider those effects, then I think the committee would have reached a very different result.
Okay, I want to return to the sort of state's role or the government's role in this, but firstly, can you just, you know, what are the definitions that are sort of necessary to understand this ruling, just in terms of a definition of a refugee seeking asylum, for example?
Sure. So I think another area in which a lot of the media coverage has been misleading is that they refer to Mr. Taitiota as a climate refugee or an alleged climate refugee. And he did try to make the argument that he was a refugee, but that's not really what the committee focused on. And the reason for that is the term refugee in international human rights law is very narrowly defined. It's essentially someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution on specified grounds. That is, if you return them back to their country, they're afraid that they're going to be persecuted, usually by the government, because they're a political dissident or because they're a racial or other minority. And that's not really what we're talking about usually when we're talking about environmental refugees or climate refugees. And so for that reason, I think most human rights tribunals and human rights experts try to avoid the term climate refugee. Having said that, though, the committee is quite clear that you, even if you're not a refugee within that narrow definition, it still could violate your human rights for a country, a government, to send you back to a country if your life would be at risk by their doing so. So, in other words, your protections, the protections under human rights law against so-called non-refoulement, the return of someone back to their home country, the protections against returning someone against their will back to their home country go beyond the protections that are granted just on the basis of refugee status. And again, New Zealand, to their credit, in the lower, you know, in the New Zealand authorities, recognize that. And that, again, as I said, they did evaluate his claims for this kind of broader protection. But it's important to realize that that's not quite the same thing as calling someone a refugee. There's another reason why I think that people kind of resist that term, and that's because often the effects of climate change or the effects of the climate crisis on people are not the only thing that's driving them to migrate. Climate acts as the effects of climate change act as a kind of multiplying factor. So it makes other kind of environmental threats worse. It makes other kinds of threats from poverty or violence often worse. So it can be hard to say the only reason this person is leaving or needs to leave this situation is because of climate change.
It's not the direct threat.
Or at least it's hard to prove that it is. It's hard to disentangle it from everything else. And so we don't want to, in other words, people don't cross borders with the label climate, you know, migrant stamped on their forehead. There may be multiple reasons why they're needing to change. And if we decide we're only going to protect the people who can qualify somehow as being displaced solely or even primarily as a result of climate change, then we're maybe not providing the protection needed for people who are leaving for a number of reasons, all of which may be quite valid and all of which are being exacerbated by climate change.
So do you think it's actually far more useful not to conflate those definitions, to actually keep them separate?
I do, yeah. I think it's unavoidable to talk about people being climate migrants. I mean, we have to have some terms to use here. But I personally do think it's more useful to try and avoid the term climate refugee. I think that gives rise to misleading analogies. I mean, let me put it this way. One reason I have a problem with this is not just the legal, you know, kind of the fact that I'm a lawyer and lawyers like to use legal terms as accurately as possible, usually. It's also that the kinds of refugees we're used to thinking about are pretty different from the kinds of climate migration that we're looking at in the future from, for example, from small island states. And what I mean by that is normally a refugee is someone who would like to be able to return home if the circumstances, the political circumstances change. So if the government changes, for example, then the idea is that person could return home. The idea is it's a temporary situation. Now, it may last a very long time, of course, and for their entire lifetime, but at least in principle, they still have a country that they could return to if the threat of persecution went away. Here, we're talking about situations that are quite likely not to be reversed on any kind of human scale. So if Kiribati, for example, really does become uninhabitable, the people who have to leave that island or that chain of islands are really in a quite different situation than historically political refugees have been in. And we have to think about it, we have to think about that problem differently as a result.
But that element of, I suppose, there, whether it be a desire or a longing or just a hope to return, would still be the same.
It would. It's just that they may not have a country to return to.
Mm. Okay, so what you're saying is that what is actually required, perhaps, is a new body of terms, even, or it's a new. We're talking about something new that we've not had to deal with before.
I think what we need is a new international legal framework. The Refugee Convention was really designed to address a different problem. And I'm afraid that if we keep thinking of these people as refugees, we'll think that we already have a legal framework capable of dealing with this problem, but we really don't. What we need is a new legal framework that addresses both the potential of saving these people from having to move, so taking more drastic and urgent action to protect their homelands, but also to think seriously now about what the consequences will be if they really do have to leave. right now, I'm afraid that these cases are going to continue to be heard on a kind of ad hoc, case-by-case, country-by-country, individual-by-individual basis. But that's really not in anybody's interest. It's certainly not in their interest. It's not in the interest of their societies. And it's not in the interest of the countries that will be hearing these cases. I mean, to put it, you know, obviously, again, the primary concern is not the consequences for New Zealand. But just to think about it from their perspective, New Zealand is not obviously the major reason why we're facing climate change. New Zealand shouldn't be expected to be the only country that's dealing with the problem of climate migration from South Pacific islands just because it happens to be one of the closer countries to those islands. Do you see what I mean? I mean, this needs to be something where other countries, certainly including the U.S. and countries from Europe, also face up to their responsibility for the consequences of their actions.
Totally. And I would like to say, though, that I think that there is a role that the New Zealand government has to play, particularly just for being close and having a relationship in the Pacific with these other islands. But like you say, absolutely. I guess the international legal framework has to come from everybody.
I think that makes more sense. I mean, again, I think it may well make sense for New Zealand and Australia and other countries in the area, you know, the region, to realize that just as a practical matter, they're going to be kind of on the, you know, closest to the problem going forward. But at the same time, I am concerned that to some degree that lets countries like the United States and Canada and Germany and, you know, many other countries off the hook more than they should be. Now, their contributions, the way that they should face up to their responsibilities may not be the same as New Zealand's. Maybe their contributions are more in other ways, financial contributions, for example. But at the same time, we're not even really starting these conversations very well about what that legal framework should look like, which countries should bear what kinds of responsibilities. That conversation hasn't even really started.
Yeah, and I'm curious about what you're saying around how it's not necessarily in people's best interest to continuously have to kind of describe their situation from an individual case after case and country by country, right? So, but I guess legal frameworks don't just kind of come out of nowhere. You need legal precedent, right, to create law. So at what point do we kind of jump ahead, or is it that we actually do need to hear these cases so more and more that government or wherever we're talking feels that responsibility?
Well, I mean, the problem with respect to the international response to climate change all along has been that essentially the international community waits until the problem rises to a certain level before it really seems to even start taking it seriously. And so while I can't say I'm very optimistic that this will be different, I do think that's a particularly inappropriate way to deal with this kind of problem. I mean, in other words, once you get to the point where people are really starting to leave, you know, it's a cliche to call them sinking states. That's not exactly true. But, you know, in any event, once people really get to the point where they feel like they have to leave these states in large numbers, then you have a crisis on your hands. And instead of dealing with that reactively, it would be so much better if we dealt with it proactively and thought ahead of time about what the proper way to deal with that situation would look like.
Mm.
And to some degree, if I can, you know, just kind of go in a little bit different direction,
totally.
I want to make clear, this should be a last resort scenario. I mean, the much better scenario, the much, much better option, of course, would be to do more to protect the people and the communities on these islands from having to leave. But if it takes facing up to the potential of perhaps millions of people having to be relocated and entire cultures essentially trying to be transplanted to other places, to make people take more seriously the urgency of doing something to forestall that, to prevent that from having to happen, then that could be a positive outcome. In other words, if people really start thinking seriously, okay, what would we do if we had, let's say, not just one person, but a million people trying to leave these islands, and other low-lying coastal areas around the world at the same time, going to other countries, in other words. What would that look like? Jeez, that would be horrible. So let's really redouble our efforts to make that not happen.
Right. So when you say you're sort of not optimistic, if we can pretend to be optimistic for a moment, and I guess, you know, take this case, how would you want governments to respond to this case? You know, what's the best case scenario in terms of action right now?
So when I very first started getting involved with human rights and climate change, it was over a decade ago now, and I was doing pro bono work for the government of the Maldives, another small island state, another low-lying coral atoll small island state, but in the Indian Ocean. And the Maldives has done various things over the years. One thing it's done is build a seawall around its capital city, its capital island, Malé, which has about 100,000 of its 300,000 residents. And it did that with the assistance of Japan. I think in some situations, that's a perfectly appropriate and urgently needed kind of response. Not all islands are going to be, I don't know if you're familiar at all with South Tarawa. I've never been there. I've just seen pictures of it. But it doesn't look to me like you could possibly build a seawall around, you know, South Tarawa, which is the one of the central islands of Kiribati. So that's not always going to work. But there are other, you know, there are other kind of adaptation measures that these islanders are taking. So I think one important thing is for the richer countries of the world, the bigger emitting countries of the world, to ask these islanders and take them seriously when they hear their answers and say, what exactly would help you right now? Like, what are you facing right now that you need assistance with in terms of adaptation? In some cases, that may be a seawall. In some cases, that may be protection of eroding beaches. I mean, there's just, you know, in some cases, it may be bringing people in from less occupied outer islands, and so it's easier to respond to sudden storm surges or other kinds of extreme climate events because you have, you know, fewer areas that you're trying to protect. But I think more needs to be done in all of those areas. But the overarching thing that needs to be done is we have to do a better job of reducing emissions now. We're just utterly failing to meet the targets that were set at the Paris Agreement. And if we don't meet those targets, then really it's going to be hard to see how these and other communities can continue to exist the way they have. And that would be an enormous loss.
Hmm. Wow. It's really difficult. Is there anything you wanted to add in relation to the case or anything else?
Well, the only other point I really want to emphasize is that this is not the only pending or recent case that in which courts or international tribunals or quasi-tribunals like this one are bringing human rights to bear on climate change. And if you're not already familiar with the Urgenda decision that the Dutch Supreme Court issued last month, I really encourage you to look at that. There have been over 1,000 climate cases brought around the world. Mike Girard, a professor at Columbia University in New York, was quoted in the New York Times as saying, this is the most important decision yet out of all those cases, because it's the first time that a court ordered a government to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions more quickly than it was doing. And it did so on the basis of international human rights law. There've got to be close to a dozen other cases like that pending courts around the world. There's another case being brought to this same committee we've been talking about, the Human Rights Committee. Another case also brought by islanders in the Torres Strait against Australia. And it's a very interesting case. I and the current special rapporteur on human rights and the environment, David Boyd, are going to file a joint amicus brief supporting the petitioners in that case. So in any event, my point is just keep an eye on all these cases, because increasingly I think courts are going to be asked to try to spur governments to take more urgent action in order to protect the human rights of the people that the governments are committed to try and protect. And while this particular case, the one we've been talking about, did not turn out to be successful for the applicant, it is just one of a myriad of cases that are going to go forward. And I think that's, if you want some cause for optimism, I think that's a cause for optimism. And remember that these cases are seeking different kinds of remedies. They're not all about, you know, people trying to prevent governments from removing them back to their home country. The Australian case, for example, makes a number of arguments, but one of them is that that Australia needs to do a better job of protecting the Torres Strait Islanders from climate change. So some of the things I was talking about earlier, you know, again, are ways to protect the human rights of people in place without returning them someplace else or arguing over that. So again, I think, you know, this is a kind of exciting development in both domestic and international law that courts are really starting to apply human rights to these kinds of problems.
And I guess, I mean, it's different in every jurisdiction, but how much can courts actually influence the government to move and take action?
Well, I mean, it depends on the country, of course, but in general, governments tend to take decisions by their courts fairly seriously. If the court orders them to do something, then it certainly makes it, let's say, more difficult not to comply with what the court is ordering them to do. I remember going to Costa Rica, which has a long history of their Supreme Court getting involved in environmental issues on the basis of its constitutional right to a healthy environment. And I talked with a member of the Costa Rican Supreme Court, and he said basically what one thing they had started to do was actually holding government officials in contempt of court if they didn't comply with the obligations. That means they would actually threaten them with putting them directly in jail if they didn't carry out the court decisions. So, you know, again, while it varies from country to country, it is something that governments have to take seriously.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.